What's up, you dirtbags? We are back in studio. I hope you guys loved the last episode. We had our Glisha Brenzel. How are we doing?
I'm doing great. What an intro.
I am so excited to have you on. I know we've been talking the last week or so just about when we wanted to do this, when we wanted to get you on. I had to cut myself off. I almost have too many topics. So I'm so excited. You and AJ, you know, we talked back in, we actually met at the Dirt World Summit. I think officially we had met before that with Crew Collab, but we went to the Dirt World Summit, not this year, but last year. I know you guys were there again this year. How did all of that go? And I already signed up for Dallas this upcoming November. So,
well, we'll see you there. So that should speak to how it went. It was the BuildWit team. You know, if you have expectations up here, they're going above that. And so between the keynote speakers and the content they had and just the environment, you leave motivated, but you also leave with actions you can do right away. And so it's almost as every speaker is the keynote, and you can't take notes fast enough. So we love it. We're looking forward to coming back next year. So we'll be glad to see you.
Yeah, I am so excited. And for a lot of you guys listening, I know I saw a lot of you the first year. I missed this year, but they have their early bird pricing up on their website. I think it's dirtworld.com or Dirt World Summit. You can just search them. We'll be there, and we're excited to see everyone there. So Alicia, our wonderful guest, you can follow her on Instagram at Alicia Brenzel and also at Brex Enterprises. And of course, your husband, AJ, got to give him a shout out at Dancing Dirt Man. He's the best. We're talking about like trying to get him in on the show, maybe not. So next time we'll just have to do like a little, we'll bring him in and have him on as well. So Alicia, one of the things I wanted to start with is the dynamic of, if anyone hasn't heard of Brex Enterprises, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the last 10 or 11 years, you guys have shot onto the scene and then also had to readjust and then like shot back up. So give us a quick, you know, snapshot of the company. You're out of Western Pennsylvania and, you know, kind of where you guys are at today, but also where, you know, how you got here.
So AJ and I started the company back in 2012, right out of school. He grew up in all types of construction. So his father built homes, his uncles did dirt work and truck hauling. And so it was just a natural fit coming out of school for him to want to start his own company. And so with my backing and my own career, we were able to start that in 2012. And the idea was just to do small excavation projects, septic, retaining walls. We bought a mini off the gate. And
what did you buy? Like, what was your first mini?
The Kobelco. I don't know. It's a Kobelco, and we still have it and we still use awesome. It. So it was used, obviously. But it's still a nice little handy machine.
Yeah.
So that was the intent. Well, through his connections with family and working on some other jobs, they started asking in the pipeline industry, hey, can you do some work for us? Just you and what was a spread boss. So he would kind of run a crew in the pipeline industry doing certain projects. And so he's like, yeah, I'll come do it. And then from there, it was like, hey, can you add a crew? Can you add some people? And so we started growing very organically in the pipeline industry doing maintenance work, and it's called midstream work. So yeah, once the pipe's in the ground, we do a range of services from everything from right-of-way mowing to landslide repair to large well pads. And so still today, that probably makes up about 75% of our business. And that operates in a couple different states. So West Virginia, Ohio, throughout PA right now. And so, you know, we call ourselves a civil and energy contractor. So 75% energy, the other 25%, depending on the year, falls into large-scale development, private development work with site utilities, those type of packages where we can come in, get everything ready, and then building up after that goes other places.
So, basically just like storm water, sewer, foundations, like everything?
pretty much found we're dabbling on the foundation side and
Gotcha.
some other type of projects, but really it's the utility side, the grading, and the site restoration, that type of thing.
Awesome. And then, so the different states, is that, do you have to be licensed differently in each state, or how does that work?
It depends on the state. So like West Virginia requires you to have a contractor license. Pennsylvania does not. And so it really just depends on the state mandates and who's kind of governing that. And sometimes it's county, sometimes it's different entities requesting that. So it really just depends on getting certified in the state first and then picking up projects as you go.
Right. And I know, so you'd mentioned, you guys started probably about 12 years ago then, and AJ was doing most of it seemed like. And then, because I believe you're in the medical device industry, was that during that beginning time?
Yep. So right out of college, I started working for a medical device manufacturer, and my background's mechanical engineering, and I was actually designing sleep apnea masks. So of all things,
Like
and
the Darth Vader masks that
yeah, yep,
sweet.
and sewing headgear and in my lab sewing and stuff. But that I loved it there. It was a great environment. About a couple years into that, I realized I was just a pretend engineer. So I never really liked creating things that I didn't know if people wanted. So they were able to send me back for my MBA. And behind the scenes, I was still running the business financially. So I would do everything, paying
Gotcha.
people, making sure, mostly making sure people were getting paid. I didn't really have the knowledge yet on profit and losses, and
Sure.
I was doing the bank account method of running a business, which works until it doesn't. So we'll talk about that later,
Yes, I can't wait to dive into
though.
that. And was your MBA, was that at Maryland?
Pitt.
Pitt. Okay. Did you go to
Yep.
Maryland at some point?
I did do a summer bioengineering internship there and loved College Park, and it was a great it was the summer I turned 21, so it was
Nice.
a nice time there. And then when I left there is when I met AJ in college.
Did you meet him
So
dancing? I don't think I ever heard the story, but
oh,
where did you
he's
guys meet?
always dancing. Well, so he always likes to make it like a big deal, but we went to rival schools growing up.
Yeah.
I knew who he was through like my boyfriend at the time, sports. They wrestled together. So I always knew who he was. He jokes, he never knew who I was.
I see.
Yeah. And so we met, he wrestled at Pitt, Maine, and then transferred to the satellite campus I was at where I played soccer. And within like 2 weeks we were dating, 8 months we were engaged. And so I guess the rest is history on that front. But yeah, he's always dancing.
That is so awesome. The dancing dirt man. I love it.
He's definitely the lively one of us. So from there, I did full-time school. We had our twins, and running my full-time job, I was starting to travel internationally. So Japan, China, Germany. It became too much to leave behind. And so about 7 years at the company I was at, Philips, I jumped ship and pretended to be a business owner in construction, not knowing anything. I was pregnant with our third child at the time, and we didn't grow a ton that year, but after after that first hurdle of me getting incorporated, we went from $1 million ish to nine in 2 years.
In 2 years. So this would have
In
been
two.
2017 to 2019.
So 2019, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So let's pause there. So 1 million to 9 million. And because most of our clients we work with, they're typically in that, I'd say, 1 to 4 million. So to see that jump in 2 years, like, was it going well or was it just chaos or what was it like?
I mean, it was going really well. We were doing oil and gas projects. And so, the big jump wasn't necessarily like, hey, we got an influx of new customers. It was, hey, we got a
Gotcha.
big project that I think at the time was $4 million. So
Gotcha.
when you're getting one project that's 50, 60% of your revenue, it really bumped us up. And so, hiring wise, we definitely had to hire. We had already been implementing systems that helped with that growth.
Like, let's, what kind of systems would you implement in that, like, to supplement that growth or to help with it?
Oh, well, I believe it was everything. We hired a lot of overhead. And because of the growth, we're like, oh yeah, let's just keep adding, let's keep adding. So we bought a shop. We, hired a, full-time admin. We had a full-time safety and HR person. And we also, right after 2019, we brought in a superintendent at a very high rate for us. And so we just started adding to the overhead side of it. And in oil and gas, your insurance is super expensive. And so that big jump. And life was good. When one of your projects is half your revenue, you don't really have to like market a lot because you're already at capacity. And so, we were very fortunate for our organic growth. But all the lessons came after.
Okay, so this is 2019, just hit 9 million. You're getting things, you're hiring people, which is exciting. You're able to pay them, of course. And so then what happens 2019, 2020, 2021?
Yeah, so everybody knows what happened in 2020. So COVID happened, and we didn't see that big of a decline because we had a lot of 2019 contracts already rolling. So, we left the end of 2019 with really good Q1 backlog already. And so we're like, hey, this is going to be awesome. We're going to have another stellar year. Well, then when that happened, a lot of the capital improvement projects that we typically see on the oil and gas side go away. And so nothing really gets put out in 2020 for 2021. And so, being that we didn't see a huge decline in 2020, we also decided to shop for our dream property and put
Perfect
a
timing.
house, right, put a house on it. And we thought, hey, we're savvy business owners. Let's bid out our own house and let's do a lot of the work ourselves. And so what ended up happening was a recipe for disaster business-wise in terms of culture, everything, because the jobs weren't out there to bid, and we had already committed to building our house. And so we had to spend a lot of time building our house, not marketing, not doing business development, not finding alternative projects. And at the time, we were 100% oil and gas industry. So we weren't diversified. So that's a whole nother lesson for another day is staying diversified. And so we created this culture of, hey, there's no work, but by the way, we're building our house, and it's beautiful. And sorry, times are tough. And so you create this culture in your company, that was terrible. I think we lost a lot of respect as business owners, and it wasn't intentional. We're not greedy people, and most of what we make goes back into the business. And so we b bought the farm to make our own straw because we were spending a lot of money on straw in our construction projects and on the pipeline side. So it all started with intentions to better the business.
Gotcha. So the farm was a part of this property where you're putting this, you call it your dream house. And it all, I totally hear what you're saying too, because it's that you mean well at it during the time, and then when everything comes crashing down, it's like that saying of you can tell who's skinny dipping when the tide goes out. And that probably happened, and you're just like, we didn't mean to be greedy or disrespectful or any of this stuff, but it absolutely kind of looks like it when you put all the pieces together. Was when that all happened and you're losing revenue, did you guys have to do layoffs, or was that kind of a mix of people leaving, or what was that dynamic like? Because the business has to survive. And so what does that look like with your people?
Well, fortunately, with all the PPP and the government support, that helped get a lot of cover a lot of our labor costs. But at the time, which I'm sure some listeners to this are as well, they're not super in ingrained in their profit and loss, and they're not really up to date on all their overhead and how to stay agile. And we weren't. So we kept all the same overhead, we tried to keep people busy in the shop, and through the skin of our teeth, we were able to make it, and contracts started coming out, and we started pursuing other markets, knowing, we can't just be in oil and gas in situations like this or ever. And so then we started leaning into municipality work and site development and trying to tap into other markets with our same skill set. And so it was like a slow crawl, in the mud out.
With barbed wire above you.
It was like a what's that race?
Oh, the Spartan race.
Yeah,
We
it's like some
just did that a couple weekends ago. That's why I was thinking about
nice.
it.
Nice. Yeah, it's kind of like that. Like everything's being thrown at you and you're just kind of one day at a time. But it takes losing 50% of your revenue to really crack down and learn, hey, how do I control my sales? How do I control my costs? How do I control all of the things I can control in my business? COVID, you can't control that. But if you can control everything else, how much further are you than 99% of your competitors? Probably a lot
So
farther.
you mentioned 50%. So is meaning like you guys went from 1 million to 9 million in 2 years, and then 2020, 2021 went back down to like 4 million.
Four, yeah, four.
Four. Oh my gosh. Okay. So obviously that's, we'll call it maybe 24 months or so. Did you expect that to happen when you're like 5 months, 8 months, 12 months into this, or did it just keep surprising you as it was dropping?
I think we just kept expecting projects to be put out. And so then when you're in that desperation, every bid you lose feels like the ground is like falling out.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure it didn't feel like that at all when you're going from one to nine, because if you lose a couple, it's like we got four more coming or two big ones coming. And but when you need it and you're selling out of desperation, you guys probably sounded different too as you're talking to these contractors, and like you guys need this. But so go back. So when was the bottom of the revenue? Was that 2021 or 2022?
2021, yeah.
2021. And because in 2020 these contracts weren't going out, it sounds like. So
Yep.
in 2021, we diversify a little bit. And then did you start seeing them coming back in 2021?
I would probably say it took till Q2 of 22.
Oh,
So
gotcha. Dang.
it took a while because a lot, I mean, we're seasonal, so a lot
Right.
of contracts aren't really coming out for January work, especially when you're desperate. Everybody's cutting their costs and everything. So it really took towards about Q2 of 22 to start seeing jobs put out there and us be able to bid in a way that was competitive. And so, from 21 to 22, we were able to jump back up to the $8 million range.
My gosh. What a
So
ride.
we were able to really jump up. But, when you go through something like that, everything feels like an issue. And so you don't really know where to fix things. And in our mindset, it's like everything was sales. Well, we just need the sales. And once we get the sales, everything will be fixed. Well, 22, 23, the big lessons we learned is you can get the sales, but unless you're controlling the costs in a way that you have visibility to where you're leaking money, you're never going to grow the way you want. And so we always had a very sales-driven approach to our business. Until 2023. And so, and that was purely from, hey, we can scale, but our margins decline. Why are we
Yeah.
doing this? Why are we running a $10 million company, profiting the same as, a $1 million company?
Yeah, it th there's definitely some I know there's like a LinkedIn post somewhere out there. It says, "Would you rather run a $1 million company that makes $400,000 a year net profit, or a $10 million company that makes $400,000 net profit?" And everyone's like, "I'll take the 1 million." And obviously, those numbers might not be accurate, but it's to say that I'm guessing is probably when you went from more managing the bank accounts to, okay, let's run a business and make sure that we have profit and we know our numbers. And talk to me more about that transition, because I know where you're at today and it's fascinating. And that's, I think I want to take some time here to talk more about the financial side of things. So what was that transition like for you? It sounded like it came out of necessity, but how did you go from kind of the bank account method to actually understanding your margins and your profits?
I'd say it's actually education. So we, out of the blue, had a consultant show up to our shop and ask us, "Hey, how are you situated for risk in your business? What is your company entity set up like? What would happen if something happens on one of your sites?" That was the first question they asked, and we were like, "I don't know. We're hanging on. We would make it work." And so we're like, "Well, maybe we'll bring them back in and just see what they have to offer." Well, this company came in, they do like a free assessment of your business, and it all starts with your P&L. And so they start breaking everything down based on margins and really seeing your P&L through a new light of here is how you use this to make decisions. And so we invested a lot of money in 2023 to learn these lessons that we now teach. And I don't think I would have been able to learn that anywhere else per se, because I wasn't looking for it, because I just had a feeling of like, hey, we're working really hard and we're not really seeing a lot of the value of it. And so that was the feeling we had, is like, hey, we call it the chest aches. It's like when things feel like freaking heavy and you're like, I don't know what to do. Like my chest hurts. Like I don't, how do I keep my employees from not being laid off? How do I find the next sale? How do I make sure we have training so people know how to do jobs? And so those were the feelings we had, but we never really tied the solution to understanding our financials. Once we were taught how to understand our financials, it was like a light bulb went on. And it was like, well, hey, I can go to my profit and loss and I can see what my gross margin's been over every single month and start tracking where it should be and making projections. And if it's not, well, now I know where to drill down and figure out where I'm losing that money. And so what would really happen in our business is that AJ was, he would never look at financials. So I could pull a profit and loss. I always did. But the only thing I knew how to use is that number on the bottom, that net profit, which a lot of people do. They just look at that, oh, well, hey, we're profiting, we're great. When in reality, I would show that to AJ and he would have like mini panic attacks because showing him financials is history data to him. Well, I can't change that now.
It's very reactive, I guess you could
It's
say, where it's in the past.
very past looking. And so the light bulb for us was knowing how to use a P&L is future looking and controlling your business that way. And so I think your original question was like, what did that look like? So that transition was us in a spot where everything felt heavy. We were working really dang hard, but our profit wasn't reflecting that. And so we were just kind of getting by. And our only solution that we knew at our leadership capability level was to increase sales. And I think that happens with a lot of people. Hey, I'm just going to focus on sales, sales, sales. Sure, that looks good from a revenue perspective, but unless you're growing your profit, it's all for nothing in our mind.
It's I wrote it down here too because I don't want to forget, but I always my coaches always say revenue is vanity, profit is sanity. And it's so true because yeah, a lot of times you can, like we were talking about, you can grow your revenue, but a lot of times I think we can all agree when you grow your revenue, usually there's a lot more problems. But if it's bearing the fruits of that labor and those issues, a lot of times we're okay with it. But if you don't have the knowledge of, and P&L, of course, for anyone that doesn't know, is profit and loss statement. So if you don't mind diving into maybe some of those tips and tricks that you learned or have learned, because I think everyone's intrigued right now where they hear like, okay, the P&L, I haven't looked all year at it. My accountant sends it to me at the end of the year. Like how can I go see that? And then also like, what should I be looking for? And any tips and tricks you have with that?
I'd say if you start anywhere, it's understanding your gross margin. And so if you need to pull a profit and loss, it's if you have an accountant, they can provide it. If you have QuickBooks, you can go right to your reports and pull that. And so what that is going to show you is essentially it's showing you what amount of money you're making. So that's your revenue. It's showing you your cost of goods, which is any dollar amount spent on the project. And so let's say, just to kind of relate like something easy, let's say I have this pen here. Any cost of good to make this pen would be like the material, putting the color on it, like anything to actually the ink, that would be a cost of good. Now, paying the admin to answer the phones for the pen company, that would fall in your overhead or your expenses. And so easy if you're like, hey, I don't even know what a P&L is, it's three parts. It's your revenue, it's your cost of goods, and it's your expenses. And so through those three things, you learn a whole lot. If you're new to P&Ls, the one thing I will tell you to go is look at your gross margin. And so your gross margin is the amount, the percentage-wise, that you are spending towards your projects. And depending on the seasonality of your business, which means you follow a season, like in Christmas, retail sales are up. That's seasonality. So if you look at your gross margin over a period of time, it should stay relatively the same. And so when I talk about gross margin, I'm talking a measure of efficiency of your business. And so the only reason your gross margin should change drastically, it's a couple of reasons. It's you underbid your projects. It could go either way, over or underbid your projects. The second feature would be you're not hitting your estimated hours. So it's efficiency based. And through those things, you can really start to figure stuff out. So what I would do is I'd go to your profit and loss, I'd see your revenue, I'd see your cost of goods amount. That'll give you a percentage of spend on per project. So roughly for us, this could be our roughly anywhere from, depending on your company, 30, 50, 70%, depending on what you do. If you're a service-based company, it's going to be like a service as in like phaser marketing. Your margins are going to be very different from somebody like us who has big, heavy equipment and a lot of costs.
And I'll just provide some insight on that. So our target gross, or I guess you could say COGS or cost of goods would be about 35%. So our target gross profit would be 65%. And then of course, what you're talking about too, the next line would be all my overhead. Yeah, the admin answering the phone, anything that's not directly related to the service that we're providing for the client. That target, I guess you could say, is would be another 30 or 35%. So that net profit target, like for a company like ours, an agency, would be about that 30% net. But it's fascinating hearing you talk about it because I've just gone into all this year of like figuring out our own numbers. And when you're talking about all this and you're working, let's say, with a client in the construction industry, at what can you help them with and what can't you help them with? And the reason that popped in my head is like, what if you look at their P&L and it is so out of this world, like not correct? At what point do you need them to get a new CPA or something like that?
So I will say when I started teaching on profit and loss, a lot of people don't even have them set up the right way. So
Gotcha.
they have no, one of my good friends, Her profit and loss didn't even have anything set as a cost of good. So sometimes when you're starting your own business, you use QuickBooks and you upload, start with their templates, and everything's auto sorted into different categories. For her, nothing went into cost of goods. So if you were to pull her information, it didn't show any amount of money being spent on project related costs. So that's the number one thing, is to actually see how your ch it's called a chart of accounts, how your chart of accounts is set up. And so that's like the very, very first piece. And I guarantee there are people that are listening that are like, I don't know. And so, it's something I can help with. It's something I have helped with. I even have a free class on understanding your P&L better too. So
Okay, the free class. So where can people access that? Because I feel like this would be super helpful.
I'll have to give you a quick way to do it, but it's for signing up for our Ready for Growth. And so it was a free class that we offered, four different sessions. You can still sign up for it. Instead of getting the live training, live Zoom training, you get all the recorded sessions. So I will put that somewhere for you.
Yes. So
We can put
Alicia,
it in the notes.
yes, we'll put in the show notes. So if anyone's listening on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, if you just go down to the description, we'll put a link to this free class and free training in there. Thank you for doing that. That is huge.
Yeah, so back to your original question was like, hey, what if their chart of accounts isn't set up right? You should, any good accountant can do it for you. That's where I would start. Start with an accountant or accountant service. If you don't have it, come to me and I can help you.
Perfect. I
And
love it.
so the process of that is really trying to figure out, you need to make sure your project costs are in cost of goods, in your COGS area of your profit and loss. Anything overhead and not related to that one specific project, getting that done, needs to go in your expenses. And so in order to use the data from your profit and loss, you need to be situated that way. And that way you can find things like gross margin, which is your money left after your project is over. And so, you mentioned yours. Ours is 70. 70% we spend on our project costs just because we have so much. And so it can fluctuate on what you do. We are a heavy civil company. If you were in hardscape or landscape, that number could be significantly less. I've worked with some landscaping companies where they're profiting 70% after their projects are done. So it really just depends.
And that's a great point too, because heavy civil, obviously the type of equipment and the materials you need, and even probably the labor and the insurance is huge. So make sure that when you're talking to somebody, you understand what business they're in. And that's why I mentioned like ours is for like typically marketing agencies. If I talk to 100 of them, their targets are roughly about those gross profit, net profit. But if you're a smaller landscaping company, Alicia has those. Like she's not going to go off of their numbers, but she's going to go off of other landscaping companies she's worked with. So, and I wanted to mention this too. So for anyone listening, if you don't feel as confident in your CPA or you don't have one, like Alicia mentioned, reach out to her. I would just say send her a message on Instagram at Alicia Brensel, or even just their business page at Brex Enterprises. Tell her you listen to the Dirtbags podcast and you're interested in just having her take a look. And like she said, she can help if it's a big enough issue, help you get a new CPA, or help coach and consult from there. So wanted to throw that in there because you're such a great resource to the industry already, but also being actionable of like this is what you do also for a living.
Yeah, and just to go back, because I know it gets a little confusing if you've never even looked at your profit and loss, you should look at your data in terms of months. And so you should be able to start looking for trends. And through those trends, you can predict what's moving forward. And so, like he mentioned, make sure you're not comparing your business to somebody else's business. Your own data is going to tell your story for you. And that's where you really need to nail down on your story to make sure that you can make predictions going forward and use it that way. And so, for example, let's just say, hey, March, April, May, June, you all had a gross margin, so this is the percentage spent on projects, of 60%. Well, then you jump to the next month and it's 85. You immediately could say, well, I underbid a job, so our labor costs were more, or I needed more equipment, or X, Y, and Z. I underbid, I didn't bid enough. That is why my costs are so much higher on that project than usual. And then you can start to plan for the next month. Okay, next month, I need to raise my prices. I need to track labor better. I need to return my rentals faster because it sat there for a while. So you can start to brainstorm ideas by realizing when stuff's out of line. But what usually happens is December comes, people pull up to see what money they've made this year, and they've lost all ability to stay agile month to month because they don't know what they're looking at month to month. They don't even look at it month to month. They probably check their bank account.
Right. Exactly. I have two things here, and
Okay.
when it comes to, like, I think of optimizing, like, okay, we're not making as much money as we want to make. Do you typically see in the construction industry the ability to optimize coming from the overhead section or coming from the cost of goods sold section? Like, which do you think is usually off more?
I think historically it's project-based costs, so your cost of goods, not
Gotcha.
necessarily your overhead.
Yeah.
And I'll back that up with a lot of people I work with are in that $10 million range and under. If they're tracking labor, they're not doing it really well. They're not doing comparisons between what was estimated and what actually happened. They're not staging their jobs in a way that's efficient. And so, for us, being that our projects are 70% of our costs, that's really where a majority of we leak profit out. And so, depending on where your costs sit, I see just a lot of people that are heavy on the project side. They're not tracking efficiencies, they're not doing that. When you look at controlling your budget, I think it's a little bit easier to tighten up there. When you have a smaller company. And so it's easy to tighten and be more agile when you're not super overhead heavy. But as you start to scale and grow, and you have 50 employees, so we have 50 employees now, for us, it's still easier to control our budget versus controlling the variables with 50 people on sites. And so it comes down to a matter of control in your business. What do you
Gotcha.
think? What would you think of where it would miss hit?
Yeah, so I love that because I have experience, of course, with more of the agency side of things, and that's why I was more curious to hear from you. In my opinion, it sounds like it's very similar. It typically the from what I've learned is the most improvement you can make is looking at the gross profit. And for example, the earlier this year we had we're about 40%, and our goal is 65%. And our net profits, of course, were a lot lower. And so I would look at our net profit and say, like, yeah, it seems a lot lower. And my financial coach would say, well, you can usually find the most room to grow in your gross profit. He said, see this, you're at 40%. Ideally, this is 60 to 65. And that gives you more room to, like, your overhead, yes, is expensive, but it's not as expensive, I believe, as the cost of goods. So when we fixed our gross profit, kind of that middle of your P&L, our net profit was fixed. And then our revenue didn't matter as much. But of course, we always want to be growing. And so we kept that growing, but that wasn't our main focus. And so I would say it's the gross profit I would take a look at first. And I think usually you can find a lot of inefficiencies in there, especially in construction. And I want to bring this up too, because like you mentioned, that 70%, I kind of get a kick out of it of, like, some people will look at, like, like I call it like canceling a Netflix subscription and feel like they did something big. But it's like if you look at a pie chart of your expenses and you see the 70% is like the project cost, let's not focus too much on the 2% of, technology and things like that. Let's focus on the 70% and see if we can adjust that by 5%. And so I think taking a look at the big chunks first, and then if you can't absolutely make that more efficient, then go smaller from there. So that's what we've done, and that's what a lot of our clients have done as well, just to try to become more profitable.
Yeah, and I would say too, if you're giving advice on like if somebody's like, hey, where do I even start? The question I always ask is you have to fit know where you're constrained. And so in a business at any one point in time, this is any business across any industry, your business is really separated into three areas: finance, operations, and sales. At any one point in time, there is a bottleneck in one of those areas that is preventing you from growing. And so historically for us, it was a lot of sales. Well, once you fix your sales, your bottleneck goes somewhere else. It can go to operations, it can go to finance, depending on the time of year. Just for an example, let's say you're a construction company coming out of winter. So you're through winter, you didn't have a ton of work, but now you're starting to get sales. That's not the bottleneck. You have the work lined up, but you don't have any cash. Because your cash was used all winter to get by. Well, your bottleneck is finance. And so then you need to look at your business in terms of finance. What can I do to remove that bottleneck? Well, once you do that, hey, maybe it shifts to operations. We need to make sure on site we're doing these couple things. And so at any one point in time, your business is going to be constrained somewhere. There's never, maybe if you're Amazon, there's never going to be the floodgates open on everything and sky's the limit because there's going to be one thing that is preventing you from growing. And when we say finance, that also means HR. So that's always a good spot to start too, like in your business, is where are you constrained? And so, for my team, we talk about it weekly. Where are we constrained this week? What can we do to help that or remove that? And then we talk about it again the next week and the next week, every week.
Yeah, and a thought on that. I feel like especially companies below 10 million in revenue that are feeling the stress. A lot of times when they look in the mirror, they're probably one of those bottlenecks in the finance, operations, or sales. And our job typically as a business owner is to blow up these bottlenecks for your team. And so, okay, this is stopping our team. And that's what you're doing of like talking with the team of like, where are we hung up? Where are we stuck? And what can I do to come in and help break that up? But if you as the owner are the bottleneck, you can't
You're
break
all
it up.
three.
Yeah, you're all three. So, and I say that with a grain of salt too. Like if you're doing 300K in revenue and you're just getting started out, you're going to wear a lot of hats. And, but just kind of fixing one of those things at a time. But as you cross probably $1 million in revenue, transitioning to being more of that advocate for your team of like, how can I make this more efficient? How can I make you do your job better and blowing up those bottlenecks?
Yeah, I mean, I could. My passion is understanding the numbers and really using it moving forward. But I am married to somebody who breaks out in hives no matter what number he looks at. It could be good. And so, for us, we function well because I can silo him from that. If you are a business owner who can't, that is where you need to start considering who can process these numbers for me, to just make sure we're on the right path. And so, really, it's about identifying, not if I can use my financials as a roadmap, but who can do it for me, whether it's a CPA, an accountant, a bookkeeper, a friend, a wife, a spouse, like whatever, somebody needs to be looking at the numbers. And so I will say that with like full like honesty, AJ does not look at any numbers whatsoever.
Yeah, and we don't want them breaking out in hives, okay? So I mentioned
No.
it before on a couple podcasts. It's something I feel so good about, but it's auditing your time, and it's a good exercise you can do. I usually do it once a quarter. On a piece of paper, you draw, four boxes, and on the left side, way on the left side, you write down every single task that you do as a business owner. So in a separate box, and then in the top left box, it's, what I love to do, what I'm great at. And then in the next box, what I love to do, what I'm not great at. Bottom left, what I hate to do, but I'm great at it. And then bottom right, what I don't love to do, what I'm, terrible at. So essentially is once you list everything out you do, it might be the P&L statements. And then all of a sudden, if you are categorizing all those tasks and you realize that I am not a financial guy, it is in the bottom right is what I don't like to do, and I'm probably the worst person to do it. That is when you would either delegate, automate, or eliminate that task. And so in AJ's example, and it happens to all of us, like if AJ is the one on the numbers and understanding everything and doing all of that, but he realizes he's so much better at a lot of other things, he needs to delegate that to somebody like you because this is your second language and you love doing this and this is fun for you. So I just think it's such a great exercise for everyone to do listening, because you're still going to have some of the things that you don't like to do, but you're probably the best person for it right now. So it's never going to be perfect, but especially in that bottom right box, you don't like to do it and you're the worst person for it. It's probably time to look at delegating that or automating it.
Great, great advice. And the first thing that popped to my mind was like me planning dinners for my family. I feel like I'm bottom.
Yeah,
I don't like
right.
to do it, and I'm terrible at grocery shopping and planning ahead. So I wish I could delegate that, but it's no one, my 10-year-olds aren't taking it up yet.
Yep, exactly. And that's a good point too, 'cause yeah, you can't like get rid of everything. So, I love this so much. If you guys have like the main point of this podcast, and I've got a few other things I want to get into, but was I really want to dive into the numbers. So, Alicia, thank you for doing that. And there's so much more. I know we're just scratching the surface. And so, guys, reach out to Alicia on Instagram. She's got that free training we'll drop in the show notes as well. But we've got a few other things here while we have you, Alicia, that we want to dive into. And one of them that I thought was, I saw it on your social media the other day, but tips when bidding to GCs. So a lot of our listeners, I would say a lot of them are in commercial or they're in residential with one day they would love to be going commercial. So when it comes to tips, pros, cons, things to look out for when bidding to GCs, like what would you tell our audience or even your clients that you work with?
Oh boy. And that series came out of, we're still in the thick of one of our most opportunities to learn on a project. And so, the thing I will say in big bold letters, everything's capitalized, exclamation points, is literally like CYA. You have to, when working with GCs, cover your ass on whatever you're doing. And what I mean by that is a couple different things. So we, our entry into bidding to GCs is relatively new. So this started, I was talking about COVID and diversifying. So us working for GCs started really back in 22 as a way to diversify out of just oil and gas, which is a heavily regulated industry and is very affected politically. So this was a nice transition for us to diversify and lower some risk in some areas. So what we started doing is we just started reaching out to some local GCs and asking for bids, and great. And so the one thing that we ended up doing was probably bidding like $55 million to different GCs with no replies back. So the first lesson I will say is really you need to really focus on building relationships before you blindly send in bids, because there are so many free portals out there. You sign up for, a portal and you could get five different requests and be like, oh yeah, this great opportunity. Here's my bid. And then nothing. And so it's a lot. We really learned that unless you have a face-to-face relationship with the person bidding it and then staying involved for their own process to award, your bid is probably not going to mean anything. It could be the lowest. Maybe they care, maybe they don't. We've found that it's really relationship based. And so before you enter a market and just start bidding to whoever, focus on creating a relationship, go to a lunch, have a meeting, figure out what's important in there. Don't waste your time. So that's the first tip. The second tip that's really like CYA is you need to know the contract and your scope of work better than the GC. And I'll tell you the reverse of that and why we learned that lesson. is typically when we bid oil and gas work, everything is spelled out, there's specs, there's everything. Well, what started happening when we started bidding the GCs is there's a lot of vagueness and there's lump sum bids. Hey, build lump sum this $4 million project. And so you lose the visibility. And so what could happen from this and what did happen to us is then we get awarded a contract. We don't really, maybe we miss things. My assumption was, well, oh, they'll do the right thing. They'll grant a change order because maybe it was unclear in these drawings. Nope, definitely not. So know your contract better than the GC. What we started doing on to really increase our win percentage is have our own bid meetings, pre-bid with these GCs. And all we had to do was say, hey, can you schedule a half hour meeting with me to run through the scope to make sure I have everything in line? And what that does is that preps you to actually read the scope so you're not turning a bid in last minute. And then it also gives you a gauge of what they know and what they're trying to do. Because when you look at it, a lot of GCs and a lot of people estimating in these big companies, their metrics are in win percentage, not building relationships, not having friends. It's turning in bids that win, and usually that's a race to the bottom. And the risk from that is always tossed to the subcontractor. So, second point is know your scope, ask questions, and really, really understand it better than them. And the third piece is kind of like an extension of that, is to really read the contracts. There was a lot of time in our business where we were so hungry for work that it was like, oh, thank God they got a contract. If I try to like change anything, they're not going to award it to me and I really need this job. I'm just going to sign it. That's going to bite you.
Yeah, worse than not getting it.
So if you're thinking, hey, I don't want to lose this opportunity because I don't want to change the payment terms or something, or I don't want to put an indemnity clause in there or something, it will bite you and probably hard. And it'll be a very expensive lesson that we are still learning and will continue to learn while this project's running. So,
What is an indemnity clause?
pretty much just saying, so this was in another project of ours, not this one I'm talking about, but making sure that if anything happens on site, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll just throw that out there, is that you guys are both covered and you're not going to blame each other and sue each other, and it's going to be both of your faults. Or be it's not like essentially it's protecting yourself that if something happens, you will be able to respond to it. And the one contract we signed, I don't even think I read it. I was just so happy to get it. They actually specified if things were to happen, they would have to appoint our lawyer. They would get to appoint them.
Wow. Probably wouldn't be
My
the one
fit
you want.
no, that's the project's going great. And my favorite, and this happens a lot, is payment terms are paid if paid, not paid when paid.
If
If
paid.
they if they are paid, they will pay you. If not, go find the owner and figure it out yourself. So I'm here to tell you, you can negotiate that and you can redline it. And the best thing we did this year was hire an attorney to review our contracts. And if you're thinking like, hey, I don't have money for that, you have money for that because it will bite you if you don't.
Yeah, I think I'm really glad you brought that up at the end because I'm sure a lot of guys are and people listening are thinking like, okay, yep, I'm gonna read all these contracts. Then they start reading, and they're like, I don't know what this stuff means. And hiring a lawyer, it's like, okay, having that person in your corner that's a part of your team, just like insurance, just like marketing, just like a consultant, materials, whatever it is, that lawyer I think is often missed, especially when they're quickly growing, from 1 million to 3 million. And maybe smaller companies. So, one other quick question I had for you in that second tip you gave of the pre-bid meeting, which I thought is very helpful. And I feel like a lot of people I know don't do that. They're kind of blindly sending their bid. Are they pretty receptive to that and like willing to jump on? And is that through Zoom or is that in person?
Yeah, so we've done it. We just started doing it this last quarter because we were bidding crazy amounts of projects and nobody would even tell us if they won or not. And so we started saying, hey, we're not going to bid this project unless we're talking to somebody. We know what they're looking for. And the last thing we expected, and this is what happened, is we found out that the contractors that know what they're doing and have good intentions versus the ones that are just looking for the lowest price and they don't care. Because when you look at it as business owners, and I'm really, it is a struggle, I try to not take things personally that happen in our business. Like, oh, they're not granting that change order because that's a personal attack at me. Like, that's how I feel. Well, a lot of these GCs you're bidding to, they're just an employee in a job who wants to go home
They're not the owner. It's
and
like,
not the owner. And they're really evaluated. I don't know this 100%, but they're probably evaluated on the amount of bids they put in and the amount they the amount they win. And so usually what happens in the GC environment, and I'm not a GC, so somebody you might have a GC that's like listening, like Alicia's totally wrong. Maybe this is just my experience. But usually what happens then is that bidding team throws the bid over the wall to the awarding team, and then everything that happens in the middle gets lost. Because and so there are separate people handling the bidding versus separate people handling the awarding. And if you're not involved and know who both of those parties are, we got overlooked all year because of that. So it's
Interesting. Yeah, you said 55 million out and none of it came back.
No, just we keep track of so something really important is to keep track of your win rate because that can help you control your sales. And so in doing that, we mark, hey, is this bid pending? Is this lost? Is this awarded? Whatever. And through that, I honestly, I without pulling it up, I know it's $200 million that we have pending out there.
Gotcha.
That
Wow. Yeah,
we're
and I think
not going to get, but nobody gets back to us.
I think that's a great point to make because I didn't know those numbers, but when I've heard some of some guys that I know bring that up, they're like, I put out like $10 million and I've only gotten like one back, or it's so little. I think the ratio is good to know that most of them are not even gonna, you might not even hear back. And so I think if you can, that pre-bid meeting, I think is fascinating. And also puts yourself out there, gets you to get to know them, but also like understand the scope. And maybe, yes, you understand the scope, but help them understand the scope of like what they're asking you to bid on. And you can clear up some of the vagueness, and so that you can put it in your contract of like, this is exactly what we're going to come and do, and this is our number and our price. And if we don't get it, that's okay because we can't afford to not, or we can't afford to get this at a lower rate. And that, I guess, that would be knowing your numbers.
Right. And the unintended effect that doing that pre-bid had that we were glad we did is we started to identify who we trust as GCs and who we want to work for. We don't want to work for the GC that's lowest number wins, like no questions asked, because that is the race to the bottom. And we are trying to put ourselves out of those tight markets. And so that's been some of our initiatives this year. And so really, there was this one project that five different GCs were bidding. We had a meeting with every single one of them. And right off the bat, AJ's like, I don't want to work with them. I'm going to add money to their bid. And so, like, you start to realize then, like, hey, I want to work with this person because they want to understand the scope. Like, if I ask them, hey, like, your site's not balanced, and the GC says, oh, well, let me ask a question. Let me get to the bottom of it. But another GC's like, I don't care. Just bid what's on there. That's going to help you weed out like who is valuable for you to work with. Because at the end of the day, the people that are low bidding just to win the bid and don't care about the scope are also the people that when you try to say, hey, this wasn't in the scope, they're going to say, yes, it was, because they have contract language saying their contract is above and beyond everything, which there is verbiage in contracts like that, and you're going to get screwed. Take it from us.
Yeah, right. It's firsthand. Oh, I love it. This is so good. I've got two more things probably
Okay.
to dive into, maybe a third. I really wanted to hear a little bit more about your hiring process, and maybe even if you have any tips and advice on that. 'Cause as you've grown, you don't grow to 50 employees by accident. And I would say it's a lot easier to have 3 employees than 10, and it's a lot easier to have 10 employees than 50. So maybe it's two-sided. It's acquisition, like how do you acquire new employees and new team members that fit your culture? And second, how do you retain them? Because if you can't retain your employees, it's going to be this endless cycle. So I'm curious to hear more about that when it comes to hiring, because you guys are in such a, I mean, like we talked earlier, like the scale up, scale back, scale up again. Wondering if you have any tips and advice for our listeners on that.
Yeah, and I mean the tips I have aren't revolutionary, but they come down to discipline. And so, when you're a fast-growing company, sometimes you just need a body. And for us, we just need a body sometimes that passes a drug test, because we do drug tests all of our employees. And so, for us, when in those high periods of growth, we would hire the only person that applied. And so, in conjunction with like our 2021, we had a bunch of employees that didn't fit our culture, and we also had high turnover then, because retaining bad people is just as damaging. And so I would say for hiring, my tips are super, super simple. Actually, check your references. There are so many times we never check references, or we didn't even require references for a lot of years. And people lie, and so you need to follow. So we made it mandatory over the last 2 years that you have to provide a reference, or you will not, you don't even apply. So that's been super, super helpful. A lot of our employees come from referrals. And so family members, local people in the community, people that see our social media. And so what we want is we want people coming in that know us and know our culture and have done their homework. And so we're checking referrals. We are asking those questions like, do you know what we do? What are our, what's our culture like? And those are important. And then the third thing is when we hire, we make sure to focus on two different areas. One, is what are your plans for the future? And so we want that growth mindset in every single person we hire. Now we do have a lot of, you might be thinking like, hey, like I have some of these older employees, they don't really have a lot of aspirations, which for us, we have employees that are 50, really getting close to 60 to retiring. And when you ask them what they want to do, they just want to operate. But that being said, the mindset you want is, hey, maybe I can learn GPS. Maybe I can learn something new. And so we ask about their growth mindset and their plans. We also ask them situational questions now. So we used to just say, hey, tell me about a time you were a good leader. And we've thus switched that to very situational things for the role you're hiring for. So let's say you're hiring a laborer for the field. Hey, tell me a time you were told to do something, but you didn't agree with what you were told. Questions like that to start getting people's mindsets on how they operate, how they would operate in their job, instead of making hypotheticals on what makes a good leader and stuff like that. And so it goes for whatever position we're hiring.
Yeah, I think you just mentioned it there, like the hypotheticals or the maybe very open-ended, where it's like, okay, I just heard this answer for 5 minutes, but I don't know what it's telling me. Like, you need a little more clarity. And yeah, like, let's give a specific example of something that could come up on site with something that's relevant to our business, something that we do every day.
Yeah, those have been really helpful. And then on, so that's kind of on the hiring side, is really nailing down on our culture and making sure people align with our culture. And so then on the retainage side, like retaining employees and turnover, we really, really focus on additional benefits besides just salary. Now, some people will leave over 50 cents. We have had that happen. But more often than not, we've polled our employees, and what they find valuable is room to grow, acknowledgement, training, and overall just being felt to be appreciated in the company. And, investing time in their future, giving them opportunities that are maybe not monetary have gone so much further for retaining some of our good people. than not. And
Yeah, I think that's so important too, because I always say, like, we're not
so,
UPS or Amazon or a company that can just pay $200,000 a year. So you have to have like these additional benefits that you're talking about and things that affect the bottom line. Because the more bottom line you have as a company, the more you can put into these things, the more you can put into resources, into training, and ultimately let them have a better career and a better life long term, instead of just the short term 50 cent an hour raise.
yeah, and I like that you talked about profit too, because I think a lot of people are always, hey, focus on your employees, culture, culture, culture. The worst thing for a culture is a non-profiting business. And
Yes.
so if there's any point I get across to anybody listening for their business, is you have to have a healthy profiting business to be able to invest those things to provide other benefits for your employees. And I always, if I post it on social media, it's always like controversial take, like profits before people. And it's not
Yeah.
necessarily like putting the people down, but we have seen what happens when you don't have profit to sustain. That is far more damaging to morale, to good employees, than everything, than when we don't do a development day or something.
Right.
And so, I always say there's always a caveat. Like, if we were greedy people and driving our Rolls Royce up to, the front of the building and all this stuff, like, I think that would be different. But we are open with our employees on our financial goals. And that's not like super granular, but they know when we're having a good year. They know how they can make it better. They know how their impact in the field day to day affects everything. And so giving them a purpose to be a part of that. And a room, like a path to grow. That's how we've been keeping our best employees. And really, our turnover, I didn't run the numbers just yet, but turnover wise this year, we've been great, because we have started putting not we're not hiring the only person that applies. We're not, we're not checking references, and all those mistakes we did make in the past,
Yeah.
have kind of gone out. And so we've have this really good core bunch of people now. And so as we look to next year, we'll be hiring more and continue the same thing.
Yeah, and really you're setting future Alicia up 6 months down the road from having to like go replace the position again and like go find somebody else and do all the training again. It's like, yeah, let's focus on our core group. Like, what do we love most about them? Why do they work so well? And really, that's attached to your core values. But then, how do we go find that next one person? That next one person that's going to stay, or we're going to keep them, and that so then they can train the next people. And I think that's when you really get moving as a business, is when it's not just the owners training the new employees, it's your employees training them, because they embody what your company is, and they don't just have to say the exact words the owner says, but they already know exactly how things are done around here. So, yeah, and it just saves you so much time and money if you can figure out the retention and just building that culture and building a place where people feel heard, they feel like they're on a career path, and they also like it. I mean, that's the big part. It's like, if they like what they're doing, that 50 cents to $2 an hour or whatever it might be, that almost washes away. But they know, as the owner, like, the owners want to take care of them, and they can feel that through the different additional benefits and the different things you guys do for them. And a big piece that I'll double down on is the acknowledgement. That is something that doesn't cost any money, that doesn't cost this or that. It's just the acknowledgement and the thank yous and the gratitude you have for your team. So, love that. So awesome. Let's see. So, last two things. We're gonna do kind of our one of our new segments. We're gonna do a shout out hour. So you're gonna do a shout out, a couple shout outs. I've got a couple here. And then last thing is a book recommendation if you have any. So we've been doing that on more of our episodes, and everyone's been loving it. So any new books that you've read or that you recommend, anything like that. So first, we'll start with a couple shout outs. Do you have any shout outs you wanna make as we're kind of nearing the end of the episode here?
Well, I would love to be selfish and promote one of my upcoming classes. And so, something we didn't super talk about is that, in addition to Brex, I also do the consulting through From the Cut. And I've partnered with one of my really good friends, Brittany Allman of Allman Landscape, and we put together this class, Primed for Growth. And what it is it's a we have two different options this year. We have an in-person or a month-long virtual workshop. We really dive into your business on all those things I talked today. So we talk marketing, we talk financials for a whole entire week, which is my favorite and not everybody else's favorite, but I love it. We're hiring, and then this year we're bringing in an estimating side on how to estimate better. So those two things are running in January. And so the time is now to sign up. And so I will put those in the notes. So go ahead. I see you're going to
Perfect.
ask a question.
What's the date of it?
The Prime for Growth, the virtual starts January 6th.
Okay,
The
perfect.
in-person is the 3rd and 4th of January.
Okay, perfect.
So
Yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes as well, and then let us know as that comes closer. We can put something on our social media too, because the Prime for Growth, I've been, following that for a while, what you guys are doing. And I just think the industry and the people listening, and it's so good because you're just providing resources, you're providing help, and really it's what you put into it is what you're going to get out. And so somebody might attend and they might not get anything out of it, but a lot of it is when you come ready to learn, similar to when we were doing our Dirtbags University webinars. People had their notepads ready, they're in a mindset, their phone is somewhere else, it's on Do Not Disturb, and they're ready to learn. So like what you guys are doing is awesome. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because we want to do anything we can to, help promote that and help bring people to your class as well.
yeah, re really, really appreciate it. It's not easy though, so I'll put the caution out there. We do make you work and we hold you accountable, but you leave January with a forecast, a budget, a cash flow sheet, a hiring plan, a new hiring process if you need it, a marketing
Dang.
plan. So you leave with valuable stuff that then you can refer back to during the year. Hey, I'm down in sales. Oh, let me go back to my marketing plan to see who I need to hit up. And so it's really what it's called, primed for growth. We are priming your business for that growth of those goals. And I always talk growth, and it's not revenue growth. It's not always revenue growth. For us, it's profit growth. I don't want to grow revenue until my profit is growing. And I think the more you accept that mindset, earlier on in your business, the better off you'll be, because revenue is flashy. Like you said, it's vanity. People love to say, oh, I'm a $10 million contractor. But if you say, hey, what's your net profit? They're probably not going to tell you.
Right.
And for just to throw it out there in full disclosure, like our target is 14%. It does not leave that much. And that's high in our civil environment. So you don't have a lot of money to waste. And so you need to have the plans in place to know how to stay agile. So that's my plug for Prime for Growth. I love doing it. It's all the lessons, I have learned, the almonds have learned, and we package it in a way that you don't have to make the same mistakes we did, because we learned all these things through what not to do.
Yeah, what I love most about that is you just show up and it's a roadmap. It's like, we're gonna go through these things. You're gonna leave with this. You're gonna put in the work, but you're gonna leave with this. Just follow our lead. And that's what's so great about it. And especially it being in January, kicking off 2025, you're post holidays, post New Year's, you're ready to go. It's not quite the busy season, so let's get after it. January 6th, we'll put all the all the links in there. If you do show up, or if you do sign up for Alicia's class, let her know that you found out because of the Dirtbags, if you got this far, because we are 1 hour and 15 minutes in. So you're a true Dirtbag listener. If you got this far, you hear this and then you take action. So that would mean a lot for me to hear. And then obviously Alicia would love to have you at that class. I've got two shout outs that I'm gonna make. One shout out would be Levi Dean with Dean Excavating. You can follow him at Dean Excavating on Instagram. We had a 30-minute call scheduled a couple days ago, and just so excited and proud of all the work he's done. And he's just one of the hardest working guys I've ever met. We talked for 1.5 hours, and it was just so cool to hear how he's always very cautious, I would say. And I know he's listening to this right now. He's cautious with his decisions. He's cautious with going full time in his business and all of this. But seeing what he's been building over the last 2 years is not surprising to somebody like me, because you hear how he talks, you hear his work ethic. One day we're going to get him on the podcast here, and it's going to be a great story for all you guys. But go give him a follow, go check out his Instagram. He is somebody that has the right characteristics, the right attitude towards business. And no matter what, he's going to go through all these ups and downs, similar to how Alicia has been talking about today. But no matter what, you're going to make it through. So huge shout out. Second shout out is Oreo shakes. I've been on a kick of those lately. So I don't know what it is, but I'll hit up Dairy Queen and get an Oreo shake or an Oreo Blizzard. And those have been getting me through the days. So those are my two big shout outs. Alicia, last thing here. If we have any book recommendations for the audience, this has been one of my favorite segments as well, but any books that you'd recommend for people?
Oh man, I have a whole list, but I would say the number one thing that really impacted me and was a different mindset for me was Building a Story Brand by Donald Miller. And it's not a typical construction book you would read, but I feel like in business, we were in a point where, it was very focused on how we were feeling and our employees. Well, through this last year and really diving into what we can offer for not only our employees, but our customers, and getting back to that, building a story for them, that has really helped us find who our ideal customer is and how we can really go above and beyond and create those relationships, to make sure we get in markets where it's not just low bid and really build that relationship. And so that was the book that kind of kicked me off into a whole new mindset, in a time where I wasn't always thinking of the customer. You always hear customers first, but when you get beat down a couple times and learn a couple hard lessons, it's not easy to think that way. So I would definitely recommend that and think about that, how you can build that story brand behind yourselves. And I'm sure you know the book, being in the market. I mean, that's like bread and butter for you, right?
Absolutely. And I've got one too, and so it's a book recommendation that I have, but it's actually the opposite. So I always want to be open and honest, but one of my favorite people in the world, Mike Rowe. I was super excited to read his book, The Way I Heard It. And I'll be honest, like, I did not like it. And like, I might be the bad guy here, but I was reading it over the last couple of weeks and I couldn't get into it. So I still love Mike Rowe. I've read some of his other books that are great, but The Way I Heard It, I'm just gonna put a stamp on it. I would not recommend. So it's
Another story for another day. We actually talked to Mike Rowe, Jay and I,
really.
and we recorded a series. He was doing, what was it, for like 811 something, on a series on contractors. And we, AJ and I, recorded a video with him like this, talking about all these things. Oh, and we got to a certain point, and AJ thought it was hilarious. We talked about like how we had five kids or something. And like Mike Rowe made a joke about, oh, like, with your company and your kids, you must have a big set of balls or something. And AJ thought it was hilarious. Well, we were like, oh, I can't wait to listen to it live when they post it. We got an email the next week saying they had recording issues on their end and the whole episode was gone. Never
No
posted.
way.
Yeah. So all I have is like a picture of like a screenshot of us talking to him, but
Oh, that's a
a big
bummer.
fan of his as well too. But
Yeah,
so that's
he's amazing. And obviously for the dirt world and the construction world, he's an icon. And yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in there, 'cause I want to be honest, and I just couldn't get into it. So
And if you're being honest, like, I don't read a lot of self-development books, which I should. I'm, more of like a fantasy reader and funny stuff. So I read to get away from work and to like
Entertain.
decompress and entertain. But the book I did give was definitely a number one recommendation. So.
Awesome. Absolutely love it. Well, Alicia, thank you so much. This has been an absolute blast. I'm so excited to see what everyone thinks, especially the dirtbags that got this far into the episode, because it just kept going and kept going. I got through like half the things I wanted to get through. And so
Yeah, we didn't even talk about our kids. You wanted to
I
talk about the
know, I
kids
know. We
and
I was like, I gotta respect her time. It's middle of the day here, but it'll just poise us for an episode 2 down the line here, and then we'll get an update on the company and everything. So can't tell you how much I appreciate it and how excited I am for everyone to listen to this.
Thanks, Luke. And I echo the sentiment back. You guys are doing amazing things. You're bringing people together. And, at the end of the day, I think the biggest thing for business owners to learn is you're not alone. If you are going through something, guarantee somebody else has learned that lesson already. And it's through podcasts like this that really make you feel like, all right, this is just a stepping stone. I just have to learn this right now. I got to do this hard thing because I know how to get better. Tomorrow. And so for us in 2021, we felt like we were the only ones and we felt like failures. Nobody else went through that. But in reality, when you start listening to podcasts and stuff like this, like it's just like a chip on your bingo card. And that's why I always refer to business as is like for us this year, it was a bingo card year. We crossed off some stuff that's never happened before and we learned the lesson and moved on. And so as you feel that bingo card, you're just becoming a better business owner. And so I thank you for having me and letting me tell my story. And I encourage anybody who ever needs help or even just an ear to listen. I'm there. I love talking business. And so thank you.
Heck yeah. Yeah, reach out to Alicia. Obviously she's been incredible today and can't wait to see you guys on the next episode. Obviously like, subscribe, comment on the episodes if you want, and then anytime you're on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, drop us a review. It helps a ton, and we'll see you on the next episode. Thanks, Alicia.